Thanks very much. Sorry I didn't have my slides put together in time to put them in the book, but I will post them on my website. See if I can figure out how to... Yeah. So I'll post that PowerPoint slide file, and some of the reprints that I will allude to and preprints are also available on that website in the technical reports section, as well as other things that related that may be of interest to you. So I invite you to sort of visit the website. I think I have put together too many slides, so I'm going to have to probably skip over some of them, but having the slides will enable you to sort of go through them at a little bit more careful pace. I'm going to start off with just a few obvious slides about phase three clinical trials, because I think when we start thinking about new kinds of designs, it's important to remember the important principles of why we're doing these clinical trials, and to make sure that with sort of the new technology we apply, we don't interfere with what we're really trying to achieve in these clinical trials. So I've always felt that good pivotal trials, good phase three trials, they ask important questions and they get reliable answers, and that's crucial. And reliable answers mean partly that they're convincing to consumers of the results, and the consumers include regulators, practicing physicians, and reimbursers, not just the sponsors of the trial. And traditionally, an important question means something like, does a new treatment administered in some specified manner, in a specified regimen or dose schedule, to a specified population of patients, a pre-characterized population of patients, result in improved patient benefit compared to treating that group of patients with a standard of care treatment? And getting a reliable answer usually means having a randomized control group, having unbiased assessment of patient outcome, that we're testing pre-specified hypotheses, and that we're controlling for multiple testing. And multiple testing gets in and creeps in various possible ways, such as interim analyses, potentially subsets, potentially multiple endpoints. And if we're talking about multiple treatment arms, then that's sort of a source of multiple analyses that traditionally, if we want reliable answers, we have to somehow control for. Now, in phase one and phase two trials, basically the objective traditionally of phase one and phase two trials is to determine what phase three trial to do, what kind of a regimen we want to include our new drug in, what kind of dose schedule, what the patient population appropriate for doing that trial is, what patient population do we have promising results enough in to warrant doing a phase three trial. All of the things basically leading to doing a pivotal trial. And there's traditionally been a fundamental difference between pivotal trial and everything we do up to that pivotal trial, in the sense that the pivotal trial is the basis for the claim that the drug works. That's a claim that has to be made to people other than the sponsor, and it's a claim that has to be documented in a way that is convincing. Everything up to that pivotal trial is sort of your personal preparation, and all it really has to be convincing to is you as a sponsor. And that's a fundamental distinction. So when we start talking about seamless phase two and three, we have to bear that in mind, that that we can't sort of then put the personal subjective aspects that traditionally are okay in phase one and phase two trials, we can't have our pivotal trials, the analysis of them, inherit that subjectivity, or otherwise we destroy our pivotal trials. So it's potentially possible to sort of make things seamless, but we have to bear that in mind. So inference in phase one and two is local. It need only satisfy the study planners. Now, adaptiveness in phase one and phase two trials can sort of help optimize the dose schedule, the regimen, the patient population, in order to help us do the right pivotal trial. And most drugs fail for a variety of reasons. They're too toxic, they're ineffective, they're not tested in the right dose schedule, regimen, or for the right population of patients. And rushing to do the wrong pivotal trial because you're concerned about the time is a big mistake. What's really important is that you wind up doing the right pivotal trial. Adaptiveness in phase three, as I've indicated, must be carefully structured to not interfere with the reliability and convincingness of the pivotal trial. And in many cases, particularly with things like predictive biomarkers, whose role is really to identify a set of patients that we want some subset of patients potentially that we want to serve as the basis for the claim for the drug. Generally, if we want that claim to be a pivotal kind of reliability claim, the data used to frame that hypothesis has to be distinct from the data used for testing that hypothesis. If we have a lot of experience in statistics we've got all kinds of tools for analyzing data. But what we don't want to do in our pivotal trial is sort of do lots of analyses with lots of predictive biomarkers and then come up with a conclusion that, now we need to do another pivotal trial to test that treatment. And actually what is often done now is we do those analyses and then we say, well, this treatment seems to work in some subset of patients that we found from analyzing lots of subsets and lots of predictive biomarkers. And that sort of claim generally just doesn't convince anybody. And that's actually sort of the state of the art today. There's lots of submissions based on that that don't go anywhere, really. It's also not ideal to say, now we have a hypothesis and we have to do another pivotal trial, a focused pivotal trial to test that hypothesis. So we would like to sort of, if we're sort of adaptive in a pivotal trial, to do it in a way that we still have a strong claim. So if there are ways of sort of, I'll try to illustrate a couple of ways of trying to use a pivotal trial in a way that we separate the data from framing hypotheses from the data from actually testing those hypotheses. So that's the trick. The trick isn't to figure out how to do an analysis on a set of data. Now, many cancer treatments benefit. Cancer oncology is the area that I know, and so that's really what I'm focusing on here. And I think some of these ideas and suggestions will have broader applications, but they really sort of come from the oncology area. Now, many cancer treatments certainly benefit only a small portion of the patients to which they're administered, and targeting the treatment to the right patient can greatly improve the therapeutic ratio of benefit to adverse effects, which is a benefit for patients and a benefit for cost to society. I'd like to sort of, since I'm using the word predictive biomarker and I will be using the word classifier, to distinguish biomarkers used as surrogate endpoints from biomarkers used as predictive classifiers. Surrogate endpoint is something that you think sort of tracks the pace of the disease. It's some sort of measurement you make before and after treatment to tell what tells whether sort of the treatment is working, or you hope tells whether the treatment is working. Maybe it's even a surrogate for clinical benefit. A predictive classifier is something totally different. It's a measurement made before treatment that enables you to select good candidates for that treatment. So surrogate endpoints are, it's a very difficult area. It's difficult to really properly validate a biomarker as a surrogate for clinical benefit. My view is what it really requires is a series of randomized trials in which you measure both this candidate biomarker and clinical outcome, and you show that the treatment versus control differences for the candidate surrogate are concordant with the treatment versus control differences for the candidate outcome. It's really not sufficient to demonstrate that the biomarker responders survive longer than the biomarker non-responders. It's not sufficient to just show there's a correlation, a patient-level correlation between the two. It's often, generally, I think, more difficult and time-consuming to properly validate a biomarker as a surrogate endpoint than it is to just use the clinical endpoint. On the other hand, biomarkers as endpoints in phase one or phase two trials don't have to be validated in that sort of strong sense. They need to have enough rationale that you trust them to for your phase one and phase two trials. Unvalidated biomarkers can also be used as early futility analyses in phase three trials, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. In general, I think validation is a term that should be handled very carefully. FDA has had some guidances in which they talk about valid biomarker and probable valid biomarker. And those really, I think, are not applicable at all to predictive classifiers. They're applicable, I think, to surrogate endpoints. Validation has meaning only as fitness for purpose, and the purpose for predictive classifiers are completely different than the purpose for biomarkers as surrogate endpoints. And when we talk about predictive biomarkers, I'm not talking just about prognostic factors. Oncology literature, at least, is full of prognostic factor studies that are almost never used because they are not therapeutically relevant. They haven't been done in the context of a homogeneous enough set of patients that you can actually then use something to say, well, this predicts who will respond to this therapy, or this predicts who has a good enough outcome untreated that you don't, say with surgery only, that you don't need cytotoxic chemotherapy. It's usually sort of a very heterogeneous set of patients, and it's very difficult to then use the prognostic factors in treatment decisions. But there certainly is an important need for predictive biomarkers that sort of indicate who is likely to benefit from a treatment. Now, in new drug development, I think the focus should be on evaluating the new drug in a population defined by a predictive classifier, not on validating the classifier. In new drug development, we're generally trying to get to evaluate a new drug, and we're going to evaluate it in some set of patients, and the purpose of the predictive biomarker is to define that set of patients. Okay, and what we want to do is show that that drug works, or see whether it works in that defined set of patients. When we're talking about predictive classifiers for restricting a widely used treatment, already approved, widely used treatment, there the focus, I think, should be evaluating the classifier, evaluating the clinical utility of the classifier. Is the clinical outcome for the population of patients in general better if the classifier is used to decide who gets what treatment than if it's not used? But for new drug development, I think that's not what we're trying to do. So one kind of developmental strategy in new drug development is to sort of develop a diagnostic classifier that identifies the patients likely to benefit to the new drug, develop a reproducible assay for that classifier, and then use that classifier to restrict eligibility to a prospectively planned evaluation of the new drug and demonstrate that hopefully that the new drug is effective in this prospectively defined set of patients. So the idea is we have some classifier that we've maybe developed during phase 2-1 and phase 2 studies, and we use it to restrict entry to our pivotal trial. And then we do some good pivotal trial on this restricted population of patients and try to show that the new drug works. Oops. And this is, I think, particularly applicable in situations where the classifier is based on essentially the target of the drug, the mechanism of action of the drug, and there's a substantial biological basis for the classifier so that you're willing to sort of restrict entry, and in fact it may be ethically unacceptable to expose the classifier negative patients to the drug because there's just not enough rationale for it. And myself and one of my postdocs published a couple of papers in which we tried to evaluate the efficiency of this design relative to a design which you don't restrict entry. And basically, the relative efficiency depends on a couple of things. It sort of depends on the specificity of the treatment effect for the benefit of the new drug versus the control for the classifier positive patients relative to the treatment effect for the classifier negative patients, and also on the proportion of patients that are classifier positive and classifier negative. And when you start talking about the treatment effect for classifier positive patients or treatment effect for classifier negative patients, you could sort of decompose that into a true specificity of the treatment for patients who maybe express some target, that component and the other component being how good is your assay for measuring whether or not that target is expressed. But often you can't really distinguish those two things. So the basic paper didn't try to distinguish it, but you can actually study those things separately. And I don't really want to take the time to sort of go through the details. I'll have these slides on the website, and the papers actually on the website. And we measured efficiency in terms of the ratio of the number of patients needed for a traditional untargeted trial to randomize compared to the number of patients you need to randomize on this targeted trial. And it's approximately, with a binary outcome, the relative number of patients you need to randomize is sort of proportional to the ratio of the treatment effects in the targeted versus untargeted. So in the untargeted trial, you're going to have a dilution of effect because presumably your treatment is more beneficial in the classifier positive than the classifier negative. So if you study the population as a whole and you don't sort of do separate analyses, you don't even measure your classifier, which would be the traditional approach, you're going to have a diluted treatment effect, and you may need a huge trial because if the treatment is only working in a subset. And in fact, in cancer, usually what you see is that the treatment effects traditionally have been small. Well, is that because the treatment works pretty homogeneously for all the patients, it's just it doesn't work very much? Or is that because some patients get a lot of benefit, it's not most of the patients? Well, I think there are examples of both, but I think there's lots of examples of the latter. So if you can identify prospectively which patients are most likely to benefit, then you can have a much larger treatment effect for that restricted subset. And of course, sample size is very critically dependent on the size of your treatment effect. Usually, regardless of what your endpoint is, the sample size or the number of events is approximately proportional to the reciprocal of the square of the treatment effect. So if you have a, if you can make the treatment effect larger, you can have a dramatic reduction in the number of patients you need to randomize. So that was one of the measures of efficiency we used. And the other one was, well, it's not just how many you need to randomize. In other words, if your classifier is only going to be positive in 25% of the patients, then you're going to have to screen a lot more patients than to get the number you need to randomize. And so we also did the comparison in terms of how many do you need to randomize for the traditional design compared to how many do you need to screen for the targeted design. And I think I missed a slide here. Somehow I had a slide that showed the relative effect in a summary table. It seems like I must have deleted that. But the way it comes out is that you can have a dramatic effect on reducing the number of patients you need to randomize. It depends on the specificity of the treatment for classifier positive versus classifier negative patients. We sort of looked at it two ways, where the treatment only works for the classifier positive and where the treatment works half as well for the classifier negative as for the classifier positive. But you can have a really dramatic effect on the number of patients you need to randomize, but in general it's a much less dramatic effect when you, in terms of the number of patients you need to screen. I think I will skip over the examples here because there is some other, quite a bit of other material I'd like to cover. We do have sort of on the website some interactive software, web-based software for actually trying out, doing those calculations of relative efficiency of a targeted design versus an untargeted design based on sort of the parameters you put in. And this is sort of the main website, and if you just go to this sample size calculation, sample size calculation icon, it takes you to several options, and one of them is to do these targeted designs, either with binary outcome or time-to-event outcome. We've now extended this with some other designs that are not shown here, but I'm not going to go through the calculations. I want to do mention another design here, and that is where in many cases you won't have enough confidence in your classifier that you're going to want to restrict eligibility to your pivotal trial. And so the kind of design one would use then would be you measure your classifier in all the patients, and you have a classifier to measure before you start your pivotal trial, and it is a classifier. It says positive versus negative, so you have sort of a cut point for it. But then you randomize both the positives and the negatives to your new treatment versus control. Now, so this second kind of developmental strategy, as I say, you don't use this classifier to restrict eligibility, but you do use it to structure a prospective analysis plan. And that's the critical thing. It's not a matter of just measuring it on the patients in this trial. Well, the company's got a bunch of things they'd like to measure. Why don't we measure them? There's a role for that, but if that's what you're doing, there's no analysis plan, clear analysis plan that sort of allocates alpha and controls for multiplicity and in terms of the way that, you know, your biomarkers are going to be used, then don't entertain much thoughts that you're going to make any claims about treatment effects and how it relates to that classifier. So the idea here is you do structure some prospective analysis plan, and a variety of analysis plans are possible, and one that I've sort of come up with is the following. You compare the new drug to the control overall for all patients ignoring the classifier, using a threshold of significance of 0.05. So if the p-value overall is less than 0.04, then you claim effectiveness for the eligible population as a whole. Otherwise, You perform a single subset analysis. You compare your new treatment to your control in classifier-positive patients. And you use a threshold of significance for that of 0.01. So if your new drug is better than control in that subset at the 0.01 level, then you claim effectiveness for classifier-positive patients. Now, of course, there's a whole variety of variants of this. You don't have to use the 0.04. You don't have to use the 0.01. There's some correlation between the tests, which you can do a little bit better with. The thing that's important here is that it's completely pre-specified how you're going to do it, and the analysis plan, sort of your testing is closely geared to your claims, to what claims you're going to make. And so that's really the point I'm trying to make here in calling it an analysis plan. So this analysis strategy itself is designed to sort of not penalize sponsors for having developed a classifier, to sort of give them a second chance without having to say, well, now I'm going to measure this classifier and I'm going to test treatment in the classifier negatives and the classifier positives separately. Well, wait a minute, if I'm going to do that, then don't I have to power those things adequately? So now I've got a clinical trial that's bigger. If I'm going to power them adequately, then I'm going to probably have a clinical trial that may be twice as big as what it had to be if I weren't measuring this classifier. Maybe not exactly twice as big, but it's going to be somewhat bigger. So you may not have that kind of confidence in the classifier to want to do that. You may. There may be circumstances where you may. That's a different analysis plan. This is an analysis plan geared to where the classifier is, predictive classifier is sort of a backup analysis. But you, nevertheless, you're going to allocate some alpha to it. And it does provide sponsors with some incentive to develop genomic classifiers. The purpose of the randomized clinical trial is to evaluate the treatment versus control overall and for the predefined subset. The purpose of the clinical trial is not to modify or refine the classifier or to reevaluate the components of the classifier or to sort of reinvent the classifier or see if you can invent some better classifier. That is not the purpose. The design assumes that you have a completely defined classifier, not a risk index, but it also has a cut point in it. So the basic overall view is procedure is you develop some completely specified genomic classifier of the patients likely to benefit. You establish reproducibility of measurement, and then you use that to design and analyze a new clinical trial to evaluate the effectiveness of the patients of the new treatment with a predefined analysis plan. The data used to develop the classifier must be distinct from the data used to test hypotheses about treatment effect in subsets determined by the classifier. The developmental studies are exploratory. Studies on which treatment effectiveness claims are to be based should be definitive studies that test the treatment hypothesis in the patient population pre-specified by the classifier. Now, there's various, I'm not really going into what all of the various kinds of ways you can develop classifiers. It will depend very much on the kind of drug you're talking about. Developing such classifiers for some kind of drugs during phase two can be too demanding, and so that leads to issues of, well, is there any way of using archived tumor specimens from other phase three trials to develop these classifiers? Yes, that's fair. Developing the classifier can be subjective and do it however you like. As long as you sort of separate the data used to test treatment hypotheses about the classifier for which you're making claims. Or are there ways of adaptively developing or refining these classifiers during the early portion of the pivotal trials themselves? And I will mention a couple of things we've done with that. One is a paper we published in Clinical Cancer Research about a year and a half ago, in which we proposed something like that. And we did it in the context of sort of gene expression profile-based classifiers, where you sort of measure expression levels of, in tumors of 20, 30, 40,000 genes, and then you develop predictive classifiers based on genes that seem to be informative of either who responds and who doesn't respond, or who responds to one treatment better than who responds to another treatment. And I'm not going to go into too much about the detail of developing those kind of classifiers. That's sort of a thing in itself. But I do want to mention sort of how we used a pivotal trial to both develop the classifier and test treatment hypotheses about a subset defined by the classifier. So the idea with this analysis plan, you do a pivotal trial comparing a new treatment to a control, and you don't have any classifier at all at the start of the trial. And at the end of the trial, but you collect specimens for patients going into this trial. And at the end of the trial, again, with this analysis plan, you compare your new treatment to your control for all patients at a significance level, say, with a threshold of 0.04. And if you reject that, then you claim broad effectiveness and you don't do anything else. Otherwise, what do you do? You use some subset of the patients for developing a classifier. Now, we did this in the context of a gene expression-based classifier, but the idea is more general and can be used essentially to refine or develop any kind of a classifier. We said the first half, it doesn't have to be half, of the patients accrued during the trial, you develop a binary classifier. Now, you can do this at the end of the trial, but you may partition your patients into those in the first half versus those in the second half to and you develop this classifier that seems to predict the subset of patients who benefit from the new treatment compared to the control, who have better outcome on the new treatment compared to the control. And then you use that classifier, you apply that classifier to the remaining half of the patients to identify the subset of classifier-positive patients. And in that subset, you compare your new treatment to the control. So it's a subset of the patients who you did not use, classifier-positive patients, but it's only also patients who were not used for developing this classifier, even though they were in the same trial. And your treatment effect there, your threshold for significance is 0.01, so that you control your overall experiment-wide type 1 error. And I won't go, again, I'm going to skip over the details here in the interest of time, but except to say that it can work, it can be an effective design, but it requires that the treatment effect in the subset be quite large, because obviously you're not going to have that many patients in that subset, because you're only looking at the classifier positive patients in the second half of the trial, and then you're going to do your test at 0.01. But in situations where you do have a treatment effect for a minority of patients, in this case 10% of the patients, and but it's a large treatment effect for that, whereas a traditional sort of trial might have a 46% power, this thing winds up having essentially an 85% power. About half of the time you wind up with the overall test positive, the other half of the time you wind up with the overall test negative, but the subset positive. And the other nice thing is that when there is no subset for which there's a treatment benefit, it doesn't create one. In other words, it controls the experiment-wise type 1 error properly. Another idea along those lines of how you can adaptively, within a pivotal trial, refine a predictive biomarker and then try to come up with strong conclusions is a paper that is not yet quite been accepted for publication, but the preprint is on the website. And this is for a situation where you actually have a predictive index of the patients who are likely to benefit from the new treatment versus control, but you don't have a cut point for it, or a cut, you're not satisfied with a cut point, selecting a cut point for it going into your pivotal trial. So you have a randomized pivotal trial comparing your new treatment to a control. You have a quantitative predictive biomarker, and maybe you have a time to event endpoint. And you have identified a unique, a univariate biomarker index thought to be predictive of the patient's likely to benefit from your new treatment, and you don't restrict eligibility. You do measure the index, and you scale, say, the biomarker to the range of 0 to 1. And the basic idea is, and we have a couple of variants of it in the paper, is you essentially calculate a statistic, in this case a likelihood ratio, a partial likelihood ratio statistic, comparing the treatment to the control in the subset of patients who have a biomarker above level little b, and you do that for every little b. And then you take the cut point that seems to give you the maximum treatment versus control difference. Okay? So it's sort of like a maximal subset, where it's maximal over the treatment versus control difference. And that gives you a test statistic, the log likelihood ratio for treatment effect in that subset of patients. We've done it here in a way that sort of weights the cut point zero more heavily. Cut point zero corresponds to all your patients. So in this variant, we weight that more heavily. And we, in calculating our test statistic, and then we generate the null distribution of that test statistic by permuting which patients are in which treatment group. And so even though then you're taking a maximal test statistic over subsets, you get a proper null distribution of that, so you can control your experiment-wise type 1 error. And you can do that test with this analysis plan using a significance level 0.05 from this permutation distribution. And we also give a way of computing interval estimates of that threshold, the optimal threshold B. And I'll skip through the details. That kind of approach can reduce your sample size dramatically compared to just comparing your new treatment to your control overall, sort of ignoring the biomarker. Particularly, as in all of these cases, in situations where the treatment is effective in a less than half of the patients. If the treatment is effective in half or more of the patients, it will have enough influence on driving the overall effect that you don't really need any of this. We have sort of a bootstrap method of getting an interval estimate of the optimal cut point B, which sort of gives you a representation. If you look at the bootstrap distribution of B, it sort of has an interpretation of the probability of treatment benefit for a patient based on the biomarker value measured for that patient, which is sort of a nice way of summarizing the result in addition to the significance test. I think I'm running out of time here. The last thing I wanted to say, well, there's two things I wanted to say here. I'm going to have to skip over a few of these slides, but I wanted to say something about just to quickly follow up on a thing I said earlier about seamless phase 2-3 trial and a way you can use things like unvalidated biomarker endpoints. This sort of the idea, and there's been a lot of talk at this meeting and a lot of interest in seamless trials, and this is a very simple kind of application of the idea in a way that I think does not interfere with the traditional objective of the pivotal trial. So the idea is you have a randomized comparison of your new treatment versus, say, standard treatment with or without the new drug. So a regimen containing your new drug versus a control regimen. And you size this trial in sort of a traditional phase 3 manner, with sort of a traditional phase 3 endpoint, say survival, if it's oncology. And however you perform, in addition to whatever other interim analysis you would be performing on your primary endpoint, say survival, You will also perform an interim futility analysis using your phase two endpoint, which could be progression-free survival, or it could be change in the biomarker level, biomarker assessed response or something. And so the idea is if treatment versus control results are not significant for this phase two endpoint, then you terminate accrual and you don't go on to doing a big pivotal trial. You try to do this hopefully at a point that's early enough that it cuts it short, and you don't claim any benefit for the drug. If the results are significant at some significance level for this intermediate endpoint, then you basically what you do is you don't make any claim, but you complete your trial. And at the end, you follow up and do analysis using the phase three endpoint. So it's a way of using an unvalidated biomarker as for a futility analysis, and it's a way of sort of then the idea. Some of the slides I skipped. What I was trying to make the point there was that in some cases to do what you really need to do is sort of a randomized phase two, a single arm phase two trial in some of these situations is not very interpretable, and particularly if you're talking about progression-free survival. And so you have to do a randomized phase two, and then a randomized phase two takes you into a realm of you're doing a larger phase two than at least you traditionally have been in oncology. And if you have to do that, then there can be an incentive for somehow be doing that in the context of your phase three trial so that you can use the patients for the phase three analysis. It has advantages and it has disadvantages, but we've done, the nice thing about it, of course, is that this interim futility analysis does not consume any of the significance level of the trial as is usually the case for futility, even if you do it with the same endpoint. The idea of you doing it with a biomarker endpoint is hopefully you can do it earlier with an endpoint that will be more sensitive. And so the idea here is you want a biomarker that's a treatment effect on that biomarker. You want it to be necessary but not necessarily sufficient for a treatment effect on your real endpoint. It's unvalidated because you don't want to sort of go through the years of effort showing that it's also sufficient for a treatment effect on your real endpoint. But so that's the notion here. I wanted to finally just mention one final topic. Are Bayesian methods more adaptive than frequentist methods? With frequentist methods, the algorithm for adaptiveness must be specified in advance. Frequentist methods can, as we all know, can do adaptive things in the context of frequentist methods, but if you want to limit the type 1 error to some specified level by 5%, then the way you're going to be adaptive has to be specified in advance, because otherwise you don't know how to, because your analysis with a frequentist method depends on your sample space, and unless you specify your algorithm for the way you're going to be adapting this in advance, then you sort of can't generate your sample space. So with frequentist methods, the algorithm for adaptiveness must be specified in advance. With Bayesian methods, of course, all prior distributions must be specified in advance. And subjective prior distributions, as I indicated before, are acceptable for phase one and phase two trials, but not really for pivotal trials. Who cares about your prior in a pivotal trial? It's your prior. It may not be the same as my prior as a regulator or somebody else's prior. There's lots of consumers of it. We don't want the strong conclusions about the trial to depend on somebody's subjective prior in a pivotal trial. So now Bayesian inference generally, traditionally, does not control type 1 error. Bayesian methods, you can sort of calibrate your prior in a way that it will control type 1 error, but you can only do that, calibration if the algorithm for adaptiveness is specified in advance. So if a regulator is going to tell you, well, you can use Bayesian methods in your pivotal trial, but it has to preserve the type 1 error at 5%, the only way you can really do the calculations and the simulations to do that is if your algorithm for adaptiveness is specified in advance. But if your algorithm for adaptiveness is specified in advance, you could actually use a frequentist method, probably, for the same thing. Frequentist designs, you know, as we know, can adaptively vary the sample size. They can incorporate multiple arm trials. Peter Thal and I published some years ago frequentist designs that sort of incorporated multiple arm trials. Frequent designs do not usually adaptively modify the randomization weight, but they could if the analysis were based on permutation significance tests. And the Bayesian designs that I've seen so far that modify the randomization weights are generally, I do not think, robust to time trends and prognostic factors. They might be made robust to that, but I usually don't see that demonstrated. So I'm not anti-Bayesian. I've published papers on Bayesian methods and have sort of been interested for years in situations where Bayesian methods offer something palpably that the frequentist methods don't. And I have found some situations where that's the case. Like I think non-inferiority trials, I think I published a paper on Bayesian non-inferiority trials where I feel that that's the right way to do a non-inferiority trial. But, you know, I think actually Bayesian methods do offer great flexibility and lots of potential, but mostly in the pre-pivotal trials, not in pivotal trials. And just would like to mention collaborators, mostly from within my branch, and also Susan Wang at the FDA. Thank you very much.
Can we go back to the Simlist phase 2-3 slide?
Sure.
The next one.
This one?
Then they have seamless phase 2.
Right, okay, here we go.
Do you please comment on, here you said if PF, in the interim analysis, PFS failed, then you don't continue for the clinical endpoint. Or, on the other hand, if PFS is significantly better in the treatment group, what's the possibility for example, in oncology trials, use PFS for accelerated approval?
Yeah. I think that's very possible. Yeah, I didn't put that on here, but that depending on, well, you know, it sort of depends. I haven't said what significant means here, and in developing these designs, that's a parameter. Now, if you want to be able to claim accelerated approval, which I think is a potentially, obviously, very valuable thing, then you would want to use a significant should mean something like 0.05. On the other hand, the 0.05, if you're not going to use it for, or if you're using some bio, if you're not going to use it for claiming accelerated approval, 0.05 for as a threshold for when you continue your trial versus when you don't may not be the best threshold. I had one slide that sort of shows the effect of overall sample size in situations where there's actually no treatment effect on survival or progression-free survival as a function of that threshold significance level. The idea being is, if you, now why is 0.05 not so good here? It's because if you're going to base that significance level on 0.05, in other words, so you're going to say it has to be significant at the 0.05 level in order for me to continue with my trial. Well, that means you don't want to do that analysis too early. You want that analysis to have good power, because that analysis could potentially hurt you. It could potentially stop you from continuing a trial that you really should continue. And so if you're going to use something like 0.05, you actually wind up in designing these trials having to do the trial at a later time in order to get adequate power. Here, these calculations, it's based on a simulation. It was done with time to event data. And when you try to do seamless phase 2-3, you run into the problem of you're trying to make decisions without as much follow-up as you might have if you're in just a phase 2 alone. And so the only way to recapture that power is it forces you to do your, what I'm calling the phase 2 analysis, at a later time, which it preserves your power for treatments that work, but for treatments that don't work, it means you wind up randomizing more patients before you kill the trial. And so, but I agree, yeah, I think there will be adequate as a basis for an accelerated approval claim, and I think it's a very nice situation because it's a situation where you actually already have the pivotal trial going.
So on the slide you mentioned that sample size, the power we use the clinical endpoint, like if we intend to use PFS for accelerated approval, should we also split our final and power the study using the PFS also?
You probably have to, you should, the power of the whole study is probably, the size necessary for the clinical endpoint is going to probably be larger than the size necessary for the PFS or biomarker endpoint. But you probably want to plan this interim analysis with the phase 2 endpoint at a time that gives you adequate power for it, yes.
Okay. Another comment is, from ethical reason, you would, in a recent approved oncology trial, in the trial design, if a patient, on the placebo group, and if a patient develops progression, then these patients are given the chance to take the active treatment. But obviously, the crossover will kind of jeopardize the overall survival. What's your comment on that?
Well, this is I think for purposes of figuring out whether the drug really works for survival, it's best not to have that crossover. In other words, if it's a disease for which progression-free survival is an acceptable base, is evidence of clinical benefit, then this kind of thing doesn't apply, because here we're assuming it's a situation in which PFS itself is not an acceptable endpoint for it. But there'll be other situations where PFS itself will be accepted as if a drug prolongs progression-free survival, that's evidence of clinical benefit. Then whether you have a crossover that influences survival, I think is not as crucial as in a situation where if you're really trying to show an effect on survival. If you're trying to show an effect on survival and you permit a crossover, I think it jeopardizes the... Now, some people say, well, but shouldn't survival's no good anyway because there are other drugs that the patient could get, so how can you show an effect on survival? Well, I don't buy that argument so much. If the state of the treatment of that disease is such that you don't need your drug to prolong survival because of other drugs that are available, I think that's just where it is.
Okay, why don't we thank Dr. Simon and... Our next speaker, now we'll start talking about some case studies, some examples of how people have actually run